On today's BizNews briefing, Donald Trump draws a line in the tariff sand. The three amigos report back from Washington. Why they went, the four preconditions, a message to farmers, and a message to business. The DA lays criminal charges against Inkabani and Figma to list in the US. Stay tuned. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of July. I'm Stuart Lohmann. US President Donald Trump says he won't extend his tariff pause beyond the 9th of July. He also warns of fresh duties on several countries if trade talks stall. Let's take a look.
Mr. President, are you thinking of extending the pause on tariffs beyond July 9th?
No, I'm not. I'm not thinking about the pause. I'll be writing letters to a lot of countries, and I think you're just starting to understand the process. We've dealt with Japan. I'm not sure if we're going to make a deal. I doubt it with Japan. They're very tough. You have to understand, they're very spoiled. I love Japan. I really like the new prime minister, too. Abe was one of my closest friends, as you know. The new prime minister is great. He's a very strong guy. But they and others are so spoiled from having ripped us off for 30, 40 years that it's really hard for them to make a deal. You know, it's very hard. As an example with Japan, they won't take rice, and yet they desperately need rice. You know that. But they won't take rice. They won't take other products that we have. But think of it. They need rice so badly, but they won't take rice. I think that was an easy one. Or the cars, as you know, they send out millions. We didn't give them one car in 10 years. They won't take any cars, but they'll sell millions. So we tell them, sorry, you can't do that. And we have a great relationship, great reliance, and really a great sort of a partnership in a way. But on trade, they've been very unfair. And those days are gone. So what I'm going to do is I'll write them a letter, say we thank you very much. And we know you can't do the kind of things that we need. And therefore, you'll pay a 30%, 35%, or whatever the number is that we determine, because we also have a very big trade deficit with Japan, as you know. And it's very unfair to the American people. So they maybe will be happy, they maybe won't be happy. But some countries we won't even allow to trade. But for the most part, we're going to determine a number, just very simply write them a nice letter, probably one page or a page and a half at the most. And it's going to be essentially congratulations. It's going to be an honor to allow you to go and do business in the United States of America, because it really is an honor to be able to do that. But we never viewed it that way in this country.
From the U.S. to South Africa, just like the three amigos, Afrikaner leaders Corne Mulder, Theo de Jager, and Gerard Poppenfuss returned from high-level meetings in Washington. Freedom Front Plus leader Corne Mulder explained to my colleague Alec Hogg why the trio were invited and the message they're bringing home.
We all know how this first 6 months of this year played out. It started off quite early in February when President Trump issued that executive order, and that shook things out very much so in South Africa by him referring specifically to the Afrikaner community by name. And then we all saw what happened after that. Mr. Rasool, who had to pack his bags and come home. And then we had some other delegations that went there, Solidarity and some others as well. And then we have the official visit by the president with his own team. We were then contacted from the United States by more than one group and more than one individual who said, but we believe that the Afrikaners' point of view should also be brought to the table, and we would like to ask Afrikaners themselves to come and do that. They invited the three of us. We didn't put our delegation together by ourselves. And I think it made sense because I'm looking from the political angle. Theo is doing the agricultural thing, and you know that that plays a huge part right from farm workers, right through expropriation, etc. And Gerard from the business side with regard to all the things that affect investments, that affect black economic empowerment and all that. So I think, with all due respect, looking back now, we were a very good team that could assist one another and played into different roles, and we were very well received.
But what next? What happens next? And indeed, what happens to the constituency that you guys represent, these Afrikanerdom's three amigos? What are Afrikaners to take from all of this?
I think we are bringing back a message of hope. a very strong message of hope. We didn't come back with the bad news. We came back with a message that says the biggest economy in the world, the strongest military power in the world, the leadership in that country, the business community has taken note of what's going on in South Africa. And I think that's positive. It's constructive. The point that we made throughout was we don't want to get solutions in isolation only for the Afrikaner people. We want South Africa to succeed. We want the country to go forward. I made very strongly the point that the biggest sufferers under this terrible policy at the moment are black people. Black young people are suffering, be unemployed, etc. And as you correctly pointed out, we do have a government that is completely ideologically driven by the ANC, the larger party at the moment. And they believe that those things are just a fait accompli and they're going to continue with that. Well, then we have to appeal to the individual citizens of South Africa directly. If the government is not prepared to take the necessary steps in the best interest of the society and the electorate out there, these things need to be communicated to ordinary citizens, black, white, colored, Indian, doesn't matter, and get across to them what South Africa can and should be like in a country where we can prosper, where we can create economic growth, where we can create jobs, where we will have stability, etc., etc. The problem at the moment is that the ANC seems to be focused on aid and not on trade. And when we went there, we said we want to put on the table a proposed deal, a deal that South Africa should have put on the table. And that is, first of all, that we should have proposals in terms of how successful trade, what is in the United States, for them as our second largest partner to continue with this relationship if we make it impossible for them to enter our market and to be part of that process. And as Steve correctly pointed out, the opportunities are endless. The market is there. They want to take what we can produce in South Africa. It can be absolutely to the benefit of everybody in South Africa to create those kind of jobs. But it seems that there's an ideological hiccup, and we have to put pressure on that. And if need be, and we will do that, we will go directly to the individual public out there and say, this can be different. There can be jobs. There can be opportunities for all of us. But then we need to do what is necessary. And it seems at the moment that there's this belief that there's no real problem. We just ride out the storm and we will come to some kind of a trade deal with the United States and they will then accept that and we can continue as is. No, it's not. And those four preconditions that we were asked to bring back to South Africa and to convey to the government are very serious. If the White House and the Trump administration says directly to you, without these conditions being met, there cannot be normal reset of relations between these two countries. And then the ANC can obviously say, well, we are not interested. We are not going to listen to this. But it will have consequences. And the people that will suffer will be the electorate. And there will come a time when the electorate says, no, not good enough, enough. I predict if the ANC goes along with this doubling down, their support will dwindle, dwindle, dwindle. Goodbye. See you later.
Just to reaffirm those four preconditions, which were interpreted here as ultimatums?
Yes, it was clearly said by the White House to us, the Trump administration said clearly, these are the conditions. And some people try to create now the impression that these things are things that we fought out. No, it's not. It addresses real concerns. Let me quickly name the four. The first one was that all rural crimes, rural attacks, farm attacks should be declared a priority crime. And it should be investigated by the hawks on that level. The second one was that the ANC should publicly distance themselves from the chant or the song in any way that has been used of kill the Boer, kill the farmer. I specifically asked in the White House, are you requesting this or want this from the government? They said, no, we want the ANC as the largest party in the government. They should denounce it. The third one was with regard to the whole question of expropriation. And they said there can be no expropriation without compensation, fair market compensation, and also after the normal legal processes to the end have been followed. And then the last one that they basically deal was black economic empowerment legislation, the race-based legislation. And they said, well, if United States companies, entities would like to invest in South Africa, but they should be exempted from that, they're not going to be part of that. Those are four absolutely important things as preconditions to normalize relations. And if South Africa thinks they can conclude a trade deal and ignore these things, let's see how it plays.
Representing the country's farming community in Washington, Theo Diaker says U.S. officials are fully informed about South Africa's realities and warns that bad policy, not race, is scaring off investment and risking AGOA.
I think in each and every one of the many meetings we had, it was very clear that those officials in the USA know exactly what's going on here. They are very, very well informed. We often say to each other when we left these meetings that the Americans are not misled by anything. They do not formulate their policies based on misinformation. They know what is happening here, and they know much more than what they read in the newspapers. Secondly, that they understand the politics of South Africa, of SADC, and of Africa. And they have not written us off. Even though in many of the circles in which I move, amongst farmers, where we thought something like AGOA is already off the table, we asked them, is there anything we can do to save AGOA? And they said, yeah, we must still decide on it. They understand that kicking us out of AGOA will hurt those who are the natural allies more than what it will hurt those who position themselves against the interests of the USA. I think the bullet is not through the church when it comes to AGOA. I think there's something that can be saved. And even in terms of these tariffs, the deadline is getting closer and closer. I think it can be saved if we do a few smart moves. Whether we can amongst the policymakers of the day, I'm a bit skeptical about that. But also, they understand that the fault lines in South Africa does not lay between black and white, rich and poor, ANC versus other political parties, DA, Freedom Front, and so on. They understand that it is about those who come to the table with integrity and those who have dubious motives of self-enrichment and nepotism and corruption. They understand that. I think also they see us as the Afrikaners, as people who can make a positive contribution, both here in South Africa and also those of us who are farming elsewhere in Africa. The message we brought home was that they look at us in a very principled way. And either we meet these demands or we will pay the price. They don't need us as much as we need them when it comes to international trade. And I must say, we also met with business people, huge business people, those who import our wines and our fruits and who distribute it through networks such as Walmart, who say to us, what you can produce, we can buy. We can buy much more than what you can produce. And we are keen to do it. When he heard that I have lychee orchards on my farm, he said, I will buy everything you can produce because last year we could not bring in enough lychees from South Africa, and your products are very popular on the American markets. The opportunities are limitless. So we said to each other, the three of us, it is worthwhile turning on the pressure on the policy environment, which is actually closing these opportunities for us. Corneille already said that we did not go there to complain about anything. We went there with a value proposition. And that value proposition was that us as farmers, as South African farmers, very specifically Afrikaner farmers, we do not claim that we understand Africa. We said to them, we know we do not understand Africa well, but we understand her much better than the Chinese, or the Americans, or the Brazilians, or the Dutch, or any of the other more aggressive investors in African agriculture. Today, we already have close to 5,000 South African and Zimbabwean farmers who are farming in 44 countries in Africa. And these farmers are not only investing in deep rural areas, they earn dollars there. And they create jobs where it is needed most. We say to them, the big war of our generation is the war on poverty and hunger on this continent. And there's only one way to win that war. That is by creating wealth. And no other sector of the economy of our region can create more wealth in a shorter space of time and on a broader basis than agriculture can. And we have shown that we understand how to do it because we've been doing it for 370 years. We spoke of the impediments. We said we struggle to get access to financing because if you do not own your farmland, if you do not have a title deed for it, you do not have collateral to offer a bank to access production financing. We said to them, the most important impediment is actually a poor policy environment. Because capital is as shy as the deer. You scare it and it runs. And we fear that the policy environment in South Africa is now scaring off the big investors. Why would you invest in a country where they can expropriate you at less than market-related value, even up to nil compensation? And why would you invest if you need to give away 30% or 51% of your business once you become successful?
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
The last of the three amigos, but in no particular order, is Niasa CEO Gerard Papenfuss. He says the US wants to trade with South Africa, but ANC ideology and BEE laws are killing investor confidence and turning SA into a hostile, failing business environment.
Well, there is a huge market that... The size of that market is so vast, Alec, and they do want to do business. I mean that the whole system there is based on enterprise doing business. That is the system, and you know there are the tariff sword hanging all over our heads, and we hear how other African countries has responded. Because what Trump has done with the duties was a negotiating measure. He says, come, let's talk. And there are ways to get around it. And other African countries have taken that opportunity and they said, and they got help. And there are people that stands ready to say, well, we'll help you. But the ideology stands in the way. And that's the bottom line. There's a country, whatever we can produce, there's a country that can absorb it. But the Americans have put a condition to that. Do not interfere with BE in terms of how we trade. Now, Tio has said, he's talking about the leeches. I mean, if the government can get its way, they won't give Tio a business license. Now, that's currently not in place. But it's there. It is on the law books that you can withhold a business license on the basis of not being properly BEE'd. Now, Americans will not deal with you under that circumstances. Now, how can we, and this is the problem. So when we go to the United States and say, listen, we want to trade with you, but we can't. The type of deals what we are forced to make is from a legislative point of view, contaminated. They will punish South Africa. Now, the question is, how do you punish South Africa without punishing the people that you don't want to punish? And they don't want to punish a particular class of people in terms of race. But they do not take kind of the fact that they said... a political group who wants to benefit and extract as much as they could out of this system for the benefit of themselves to the detriment of everybody, to the detriment of their own people. And if you look at how many people are unemployed, how many the youth unemployment, how many people get grants. I mean, the figures are staggering. The system is about to fail. It is failing. Now, at what point will you say this is a failed state? I mean, there's not a point where you say this is actually the case. But the point is, it is in our hands. And there needs to be as much pressure on this government as possible. Now, why the United States? Well, at least it's one country that stood up and say, we take note what is happening in South Africa. And they raised their voice. And we appreciate that. The others are reluctant to speak out. We know that business people in Europe are very concerned about what's happening. This morning we heard about Mercedes-Benz that apparently show signs of they want to leave. I mean, I've heard that for quite a while. They can't survive in this environment. And how can a government, when they see that, and I mean, Mercedes-Benz leave the Eastern Cape, can you imagine? And then the rest will follow. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The world doesn't want to do business with this country. It is a hostile business environment. Why will you take your money and come invest here if there's a government that is hostile to business and outspoken hostile to business? So, you know, this is it. If the government wants to go down this route, it's difficult. There's difficult times ahead. But here's the government of the United States has said, this is our conditions. And what do we expect? I don't expect anything because they are ideologically so entrenched in what they do that they cannot escape that. And then the population will have to vote them out. That's the only way. But in the meantime, we'll have to raise our voices as hard as we could.
That whole discussion is available on BizNews TV on YouTube, and a reminder to non-subscribers, you can do so below. Now, the DA is laying criminal charges against High Education Minister Nebogile Nkabani, accusing her of fraud and lying to Parliament over ANC-linked CETA appointments. The party has also slammed President Ramaphosa for refusing to act.
We're here today at the Cape Town Central Police Station to lay criminal charges against Nebogile Nkabani, the Minister of Higher Education, for misleading Parliament and committing an act of fraud as per the laws of the country.
President Ramaphosa refuses to be as good as his word and act against corruption, act against criminality in our Parliament. Those kinds of actions go unchecked. Our colleague Karabo Gagau then went and did an entire table of everybody who was appointed and discovered, lo and behold, that there were a whole lot of deployed ANC cadres.
Advocate Terry Motau did not chair this panel, which begs two questions. One, does this panel actually exist? Two, if it does exist, who exactly is the chairperson of this panel? We are here today to make sure that our fight against corruption is consistently heard. Since she's took up office, she hasn't transformed NSFAS. NSFAS is still a mess. Student accommodation is still a mess. Allowances are still a mess. Tuition fees are still a mess. And therefore, we are of the 100% firm view as the DA that not only does she deserve to be charged, she also does not deserve the power and the delegation to use the state's money. And that is why we will not be voting in favor of her budget.
And lastly, design software firm Figma has filed for a US IPO, marking one of the most anticipated tech listings of the year. Our partners at Bloomberg report.
We could be. I mean, there's a lot of interest right now in software companies that are managing to continue growing at this kind of ridiculously rapid pace, this north of 40% that Figma is doing. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for Figma. The big question for them is, they have a core product of designing applications for computers, for phones, designing them. Can they expand into workplace apps? Can they expand into other creative tools? That's what's going to determine whether they're a Zoom, they make one thing well, or whether they're a true platform company.
That's a good question. Of course, Adobe, its former suitor, has moved on to really play in the AI playground here. Does Figma have that same opportunity?
all these software companies want to tell an AI story. For Figma, it's that we're going to make designers more capable with AI. Mm. They also disclose a risk in their filings that if AI gets so good, there might be less designers in the economy because you don't need to hire as many of them. And we're selling software per user, and that could be bad for us. So that's the kind of eternal question for these vendors right now.
I am curious about the health of the company's finances. We just laid out the revenue and, of course, the loss per share last year that we point out for the most recent quarter, the first quarter, they did actually have net income. And when you look at the income statement and the balance sheet that they disclose in the S1, what is it telling you?
It's telling us that, yeah, they're still a high-growth software company. There's been this trend of software companies kind of staying private as long as they can, almost until they're turning a profit. Databricks comes to mind. Mm. They are IPOing a little sooner, and they call out in their report that AI is going to weigh on their efficiency, on their profit for a little while. Is that an excuse? Is that the button you press when your profits are low? It could be, but they got a lot of cash on the balance sheet. They got $1 billion, and you know, $60 million of that is in Bitcoin, and so they have Bitcoin. They have a lot of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. CEO Dylan Field, well known as a Bitcoin guy, so you know they're putting their money where their mouth is.
Wonderful.
Well, they've seen how it pays off for a company like Strategy, so why not just include Bitcoin in your financial statements, right?
Right.
Brody Ford, thank you so much. Bloomberg's Brody Ford.
And that's it for today's show. A big thanks to the BizNews production team. From me, Stuart Lerman. Until next time.